This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. It's generally assumed now that the dinosaurs were done in by a giant asteroid that struck the planet tens of millions of years ago. But what was the catalyst for that cosmic crash? Some new creative thinking postulates that the culprit was a cluster of dark matter, a gravity-like force that nudged a celestial body into a destiny of destruction on planet Earth. Lisa Randall is a professor of physics at Harvard University. She's author of the new book, Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. She joins us here in our CUNY studios. Welcome. Always good to see you.
You too. Thanks for having me here.
You're a particle physicist. You work on extra dimensions, small quantum scale stuff. What got you interested in dinosaurs?
It's really fun for me. We started off trying to understand dark matter. I do particle physics, but that could be any type of particle. It could be the familiar matter we know, but it could be this exotic form of matter we call dark matter, which particle physicists are also trying to understand. After all, there's five times as much of it as in terms of the energy it carries than ordinary matter. So particle physicists think about that. And in particular, my collaborators and I were trying to explain an observational result that's actually since gone away, but we were trying to figure out, could dark matter be different than people had assumed? And in fact, could it be collected more densely? And this led to an idea that very naturally led to the idea that dark matter, at least some dark matter, might collect in a disk. And if it did so, then its enhanced gravitational force could actually trigger not asteroids, but comets from the distant Oort cloud. Like, you know, their Oort cloud is very far away. It's
right.
50,000 times as far away from the sun as the Earth. And that means stuff there is pretty weakly bound. So an enhanced gravitational force would make a difference.
So let's take the whole big picture and set the scene. So our planet is in a section of the Milky Way, which is a galaxy that has a lot of dark matter in it, right?
So I would say our planet's part of the solar system, which is a star in this galaxy. And absolutely, it's the Milky Way galaxy.
And so how does the dark matter then affect something that gets to us? Give us a scenario that's happening.
So let's first talk about just most of the dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
So the Milky Way galaxy has an enormous spherical halo of dark matter that surrounds us. And in that spherical halo is the stuff that we're familiar with, the Milky Way plane. That's that bright white milky set of stars that you see in a clear night sky. And you can first think about that fact. So there's ordinary matter. Even though there's one-fifth of dark matter, it's condensed. It's condensed into this disk. And so that's what you have in this, and that's where we are. We're sitting in there, and our solar system there. And the reason we know there's dark matter is because if you look at the speed of stars, they're going much faster than they could if you just had the gravitational attraction of ordinary matter. There has to be something else there, and it's something we're not seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's dark matter. So that's most of the dark matter. And dark matter actually, we ignore it a lot of the time, but it actually was responsible for things like structure in the universe, forming galaxies in the lifetime of the universe. It's pretty important. It had a pretty important role, and it has an important role today in that it's kind of holding everything together. But what we proposed was, in addition to that, which we actually do know is there, this is speculation, our theory, but we said maybe some small fraction of the dark matter is a little different in the sense that it has interactions aside from just gravity. And because it's a small fraction, say 5%, it doesn't change any of the story I just told you. However, it would have this amazing implication, which would be a dark disk that sits inside the midplane of the Milky Way. And that could have a gravitational force that also affects the motion of stars and also could conceivably dislodge comets from the distant Oort cloud.
You mean as the disk is rotating, our whole galaxy is rotating, it could suck in a comet maybe?
It's a little bit like that, but what's really going on is that all the stars are rotating around.
Yeah.
As the sun rotates around, it also bobs up and down slightly. So it's this with a picture, but just imagine something that's rotating around but also oscillating up and down.
Right, like a top sort of thing.
Well, but let's just picture a big plane, a little bit like that, but a big plane, and something's just circling around it. But sometimes it's above it, sometimes it's below it. And to get from the top to the bottom, it has to go through it. And every time it goes through, which we postulate happens about every 30 or 35 million years, every time it goes through, it's going to hit this disk of dark matter. And at those times, the gravitational force will be enhanced, the tidal gravitational force from the dark matter. And that's when we would see enhanced comet strikes.
So if you run the clock, the clock about this rotation, would you find that at 66 million years ago, something like that? We'd be rotating at the exact point where that might have happened?
So we probably passed through the midplane about 2 million years ago.
Yeah.
So if we go through it every 32 million years, then yes, that's what would happen. And the reason this theory, I mean, again, it's speculation, but the support for this idea is that it's really remarkable. You can go to look on the web and go to the Earth Impact Database and find the craters, the big craters that have been found on Earth. You can find all the craters that have been found.
Mm-hmm.
But if you focus on the big craters, that is to say, ones, say, bigger than 20 kilometers, that's pretty big, you find that it looks like there's a bit of an enhancement every 30 million years. And so you have to then do careful statistics and see, is there some evidence that there's an enhanced rate of these large impacts every 30 million years? And it seems to be the case.
Our number 844-724-8255. We've known each other, as I say, for years, and you're a theoretical physicist, and I'm reading this book, and you're discovering something that we journalists have known about for years, because we cover lots of different stuff, but you're so really narrowly focused, and I'm reading the joy that you're having in discovering stuff outside of your laboratory. Tell us a little bit about that.
So let me just clarify that. I don't have a laboratory because I do theory, and
right.
That's one of the reasons that I can move around. But it was really fun, not just to be able to learn about other fields. So what I did in this book was not just talk about cosmology, which is something I've worked on, but also the solar system and extinctions and life. In fact, when I was writing this book, I thought, why did no one talk more about the sixth extinction? And then a book came out on it. It really, really was fun discovering all these. I mean, obviously, that's not a fun thing to discover in the sense of what it means for the world.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
But to learn more about geology and the solar system and things that we sort of have the story that we had since high school, but there's a lot that we've learned since then. And it was really fun for me to be able to tie this together because of the connection to the comets and somewhat to the asteroids. But it was also just very interesting to see what it was like to learn a new field, to really be able to try to get it rigorously. And you realize how difficult it can be to read the literature in another field because it changes over time. So you really have to have a lot of sources and make sure that you really are coming to the right answer. And so I did a lot of research in order to go all the way from cosmology and dark matter down to solar system and even how life might have emerged on Earth and certainly how it went away.
Did you get your hands dirty, literally, going to the ground and looking at volcanoes and stuff like that?
Well, you know, I do the kind of thing anyway because I really like the outdoors. And one of the things that writing this book did is make me actually appreciate, I mean, I of course, as a scientist, I already had that, but really think more about where all the stuff on Earth came from. And one of the really nice coincidences that I mentioned in the book is I actually just happened to be in the Basque Country giving a physics lecture and talking to a colleague who said, oh, my cousin's a geologist. Do you know the KT boundary is right near here, which is the boundary where the dinosaurs disappeared? So we organized a little trip, and it was the most beautiful beach I ever was. And we got to actually get our hands dirty and get a little bit wet.
Did you actually see the layer?
We actually saw the layer. It was incredible. It really was so exciting.
That's exciting stuff. You
could see where it was light because there were fossils, and you could see where most of the fossils went away, and it was dark gray. It was incredible.
Yeah. To me, it's the equivalent of looking through a telescope for the first time. I remember this years ago, and actually seeing a real planet. It's not on television or in a movie. You're really looking at it.
Planet aside from ours.
Remember, it was the rings of Saturn. They happened to be turned around just right.
I mean, it's funny because, you know, I'm always skeptical about it because you think, oh, well, you know, I read about this. I know it's there. But when you actually experience it, and I think that's one of the reasons I really wanted to write this book was to sort of say not just what's here now, but how did we get here?
Yeah.
What were all the many stages in terms of the evolution of the universe, the evolution of the solar system, the evolution of the Earth that got us here? And how rapidly are we changing that to really appreciate more what all of this means?
And it's really well written because you write it from an eye of someone who's newly discovering these things. It's just very easily well written. In case you just joined us, I'm talking with Lisa Randall. She's no stranger to Science Friday and probably to you, a professor of physics at Harvard. The book is Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, the Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. While I have you here, I've got a particle physicist here, because there was something really interesting happened. Researchers at Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands say they have proved that spooky action at a distance is real. Are you familiar with that?
I am. I would never personally use the word spooky or
Albert Einstein used the word.
I know, but I'm not Einstein, believe it or not. But what I mean, so quantum mechanics you know, once you accept the rules of quantum mechanics, you know, once you accept the rules of quantum mechanics, you can produce a state where things are related and then separate them, and they stay related. So it seems incredibly mysterious, but the fact is they work at some point. So there's a way in which it's not spooky, in which it makes sense. I mean, it's certainly true that it is incredible that things that can't actively communicate, mm-hmm. but if they were related at some point, it's a little bit less confusing. And what it's saying is that it really is in this quantum entangled state. And that is a very interesting thing. Don't get me wrong. But it's actually part of the theory. I mean, it's more like people have been beating at it for years trying to say, I don't believe this. There must be something wrong with it.
I know you're a scientist. You understand this. But the theory says that if we move two interconnected particles, mm-hmm. entangled particles, one to each end of the universe, they will simultaneously know what the other one is doing faster than the speed of light, faster than our minds can think about it. That seems spooky, even as Einstein called it.
Yeah, I understand.
It's not spooky to you as a quantum physicist.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's when I was talking about particle physics in my freshman seminar, you know, the freshmen were great. And they actually said, you know, it's like a form of empathy that you know the kind of scales that you're familiar with, but you don't know the scales that you don't experience in your daily life. If we were living at the scale of an atom, probably the rules of quantum mechanics wouldn't seem so mysterious to us. But it's just not the rules with which we're familiar. But if you just clear your head and say, I'm going to live by the rules of quantum mechanics, it's less spooky. It's part of the rules. It's part of the way things work. And what people are trying to do is say, you know, for years people were hoping maybe there's some explanation in terms of the way we look at things. Right. Maybe there's some classical thing. And that just isn't the case. Quantum mechanics is actually correct.
Mm-hmm. I like the way Feynman always talked about it. He said, it's crazy stuff, but it's true. Yeah, it is.
And it's important to realize we see it as crazy. If you were living at the scale of an atom, you'd think we were pretty crazy, maybe.
Yeah. George Gamow, the physicist, he wrote a book called Mr. Tompkins in Relativity Land. Mm-hmm. It was serialized in the 30s, I think, in the New Yorker magazine. And he wrote about basically what you're saying. Let's put a person in, you know, who lives in a speed that's fast enough, the town.
Right.
And he describes what's going on, and you can explain relativity that way by changes in speed and size.
And, you know, I've tried to explain a lot of scientific concepts, and you really realize that's what it boils down to, is just getting people to the point where they can realize you have to stop seeing it from the reference frame that you're familiar with. I mean, look at dark matter. Well, don't look at it because you can't see it. But dark matter, it's matter. It just doesn't interact with light, which means we will never see it with our senses. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. We see it indirectly through its gravitational effects.
Take dark matter, please. That's the line you're going to come up with. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Lisa Randall, a great new book she has, Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, the Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. Let's see if we can get a call in or two, some folks with interesting questions. Warren in San Rafael, California. Hi, Warren.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was wondering, you mentioned that the dark matter forms a disk, and why wouldn't it form in a sphere?
Right, that's a really good question, and most of it does form in a sphere. I tried to be clear about that, and if I wasn't, I apologize. What I'm saying is maybe, just like ordinary matter can radiate. So let's first ask, why is there a Milky Way disk? Well, there's a Milky Way disk because ordinary matter can radiate, that is to say, emit photons, particles that communicate light, and thereby cool down. And because it can cool down, it doesn't make the kind of excursions that the other particles will, the dark matter, and it collapses into a disk. It's a disk because angular momentum is conserved. So it's not a small ball, but it's a disk. But the key point is that it could radiate and cool down. That was what was important. So what my collaborators and I proposed is perhaps there's some part of the dark matter, not all of the dark matter, but some fraction of the dark matter that behaves similarly. And it's kind of fun because you really get outside your reference frame. You say maybe dark matter too interacts via light, but not our light, maybe some kind of dark light, its own light that allows it to radiate and form a disk. So it's only this small fraction of dark matter that's charged under a dark force, a dark light, that even has the possibility of doing that, and that's our proposal.
Are you ever going to be able to test your proposal?
One of the really amazing things, and as you know, in particle physics, you have to wait years for things.
Right.
But one of the great things when we were doing this research, and we were finishing it up in the summer, that fall, something called the Gaia satellite was set to launch, which is measuring the position and velocities of a billion stars in the Milky Way. And if you think about it, if you know the shape of the galaxy, if you know its gravitational potential, you then can determine what is the motion of the stars. So actually, by measuring, doing these precise measurements of position and velocity of the stars, we're going to be able to reconstruct what the galaxy looks like and see if this dark disk is there.
Very, very interesting. I know you worked with a whole range of scientists for this research. You were mentioning them a bit. Any other area outside of physics now that you're hooked on that you want to know more about?
That's a great question. I have to say, there's very little science that I'm not interested in. I guess I'm not interested in lists of names, but once there's actually ways of hoping to understand things, it gets pretty exciting. And certainly everything that's led to where we are today. I mean, I have to say, paleontology and geology are just fantastic. I mean, as you know, I like rock climbing, so you're looking at rocks all the time. So just finding out all the information, you know, these rocks tell a story. They have a history. And figuring out, and of course, that's rocks on Earth, and now we're studying rocks in other places. It's really remarkable, the amount we're learning.
And now that you have found an interconnection with something else, you can appreciate the rocks better now because they're connected to something else.
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is basic stuff that we knew, but stuff that I didn't ever think about. You know, we know there's a carbon cycle, but plate tectonics plays a role in that. And the mantle is being heated by nuclear forces. So kind of these connections between, you know, we have dark matter. Dark matter gave rise to the formation of galaxies. We know that heavy elements, such as carbon, essential to life, are formed in supernova. It's these connections between this very basic stuff that I study and the stuff that makes up life in the planet that's amazing and astounding.
That's the fun part. You're learning something new all the time. Lisa Randall, thank you for taking time to be with us today. It's always
thank
a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me here. It was a lot of fun.
Lisa Randall, professor of physics at Harvard. She's also author of the new book, Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. It's a lesson in all kinds of science in there and her journey of how she found this connectedness. Great book. Recommended to everybody. Also, we have an excerpt from our book. If you want to read a piece of it, it's on our website at sciencefriday.com.